Welcome back, everybody. It's good to see so many familiar faces at this point, because this is, if my arithmetic is correct, never trust my arithmetic, by the way. That's why I do literature. If my arithmetic is correct, it's the 7th of 8, and we are now on the day before yesterday. Yesterday, as Dr. Kissinger was suggesting, yesterday was the 20th century. The day before yesterday was the 19th century. So what I've tried to do with this series is to show that that history is a tapestry of Homo viator, Homo superbus, and then Phobos, right? Pilgrim man, proud man, and he who looks up with wonder, poetic man, should we say. And I've tried to show in every single century how this battle, if you like, in the good and the bad, animated by the beautiful, is what animates history. So the book, when it's published, will be The Good, the Bad, and the Beautiful, History of Christendom in Three Dimensions. So we're going to continue that structure here, the 19th century. And there's going to be less ad lib on my part, because the previous centuries, like particularly the first lecture, I think, was on the first five centuries. So I had to, if you like, condense five chapters into one 45-minute talk. Because the whole structure of the book was one chapter per century. But as the last two lectures are on the 19th and 20th century respectively, it's one chapter per lecture, which means I don't actually have to condense. I can largely include exactly what I'm going to say. So this is largely going to be the text of my chapter on the 19th century. I hope this will entice you to buy the book when it's published. I have no idea when that will be. Hopefully sometime before Christmas. And I'll maybe add a few extra comments where I think it's appropriate, but I'm largely going to stay with the text. So the 19th century, the title of the chapter I've given is Revolution, Revelation, and Revival. So succumbing to my own predilection for alliteration. So we begin with the good. At the beginning of the 19th century, dispassionate skeptics and cynics could have been forgiven for believing that the Catholic Church was finished. Even the faithful must have faltered in their belief that the Church could survive the precarious predicament in which it found itself. After being bruised and abused by the rise of absolutist monarchs, and after the Pope had been bullied into suppressing the Jesuits, his greatest allies, the Church had then found itself betrayed by France, its oldest daughter, with the revolution's unleashing of hell itself on the Catholic population and priesthood. As the sun set on the 18th century, with a weak Pope dying as a prisoner of Napoleon in France, it must have seemed that the sun was finally setting on the Church. And yet, as Chesterton reminds us, the Church, as the mystical body of Christ, has the ability to conquer death itself. Quote, Christendom has had a series of revolutions, and in each one of them, Christianity has died. Christianity has died many times and has risen again. For it had a God who knew the way out of the grave. It is therefore in the spirit of resurrection that the 19th century begins. The first sign of resurrection was the Concordat signed by Napoleon and the new Pope, Pius VII, in 1801. Napoleon realized that he needed to pacify and placate the Catholics of France and Italy in order to consolidate his political power. The rising in the Vendée has shown how large sections of France still held firm to the faith, and the armed resistance of the Catholic loyalists in Italy had indicated the need to come to terms with the moral authority of the Church, even if militarily Christendom was defenseless. Napoleon considered the Pope a lever of opinion, whose moral authority was equivalent to a corps of 200,000 men. It was therefore Napoleon's fear of insurrection which led to the Church's resurrection. Napoleon began his rapprochement to the church and courtship of the Pope in a speech to the clergy of Milan in June 1800. Considering that he had been one of the political and military leaders of the rapidly anti-Christian revolution, his words reflect a startling change of heart, or in any event, a firm and cynical grasp of real politics. Quote, Napoleon, "I am sure that the Catholic religion is the only religion that can make a stable community happy and establish the foundations of good government. I undertake to defend it always. I intend that the Roman Catholic religion shall be practiced openly and in all its fullness. France has had her eyes opened through suffering and has seen that the Catholic religion is the single anchor amid storm. Tell the Pope that I want to make him a present of 30 million Frenchmen." Even though Napoleon was no doubt motivated by a cynical desire to use the church, he was simultaneously acting as an unwitting agent of divine providence, enabling the church to rise from the dust and ashes of its own apparent defeat. Following the signing of the Concordat, Napoleon was as good as his word, at least for a time. He restored religious education for children and returned seminaries to the church. Then, in 1804, he became emperor and allowed the absolute power to go to his head. In the same manner as the absolutist monarchs of the previous century, he asserted his imperial right to oversee church appointments and to judge matters of teaching, imprisoning dissident cardinals, bishops, and priests. A standoff between the Pope and the Emperor ensued when Napoleon demanded that the Pope take his side in his wars with Britain and other nations. The Pope refused. Napoleon responded by ordering his army to invade Rome and the Papal States, taking the Pope prisoner. Pius VII would be a captive of the French for 6 years, from 1808 to 1814, and would emerge triumphant in terms of the great moral victory he accomplished in his resolute refusal to surrender his authority to the emperor. He became a hero of resistance in the eyes of the wider world, bolstering the status of the papacy internationally. In England, horror at the barbarism of the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror that followed in its wake led to a spontaneous outpouring of sympathy for the revolution's victims. Britain opened its doors to refugees from France. As a point here, that Britain had been extremely anti-Catholic at this stage, the government at least, for 2.5 centuries. And it took the French Revolution to soften the British government to Catholicism. Britain opened its doors to refugees from France, including no fewer than 8,000 emigre priests who were permitted to minister to England's beleaguered Catholics. Such was the unforeseeable blessing that the French Revolution bestowed upon England, albeit contrary to the desires of the revolutionaries. Such are the ways in which the hand of Providence writes straight with crooked lines, bringing ineffable good upon unutterable evil. Something similar to what was happening in England was also happening in the United States. Quote, this is from a book by a historian called Christopher Shannon called American Pilgrimage, History of the Catholic Church in America. Quote, "The vicious anti-clericalism and persecution of the church under the French Revolution called Bishop John Carroll and other American clerics to temper their enthusiasm for the new politics. So, too, many of those clerics were in fact French priests living in exile from revolutionary France and not inclined to entertain fine distinctions between good and bad republicanism." In other words, the French Revolution actually caused the Catholic Church in the United States to become more, whatever better word, conservative. By the 1830s, Catholicism was growing so fast in the United States that the French writer Alexis de Tocqueville remarked that, quote, America is the country in which the Roman Catholic religion is making the most progress. Such progress was due in large part to the large-scale emigration from Catholic countries in Europe. From being only 3% of the population at the time of the nation's founding, Catholicism would become the largest Christian denomination by the middle of the 19th century. One of the chief marks of the resurrected power of the Church was the re-establishment of the Society of Jesus by Pius VII. In 1814.
In the following year, even as Napoleon was meeting his literal Waterloo, the Society of Foreign Missions was re-established. With the resurrected Jesuits at the helm, Catholic missions were revitalized around the world. The fearlessness of Pius VII set the tone for his successors throughout the century. The 19th century was a golden age of the papacy. Leo XII was active in supporting the Jesuits. His successor, Pius VIII, condemned Masonic secret societies, an acknowledgement of the key role that such societies had played in the French Revolution and would continue to play in revolutionary movements throughout the 19th century. Gregory XVI, especially in his encyclical Mirari Vos, issued in 1832, was even more resolute in his attacks on the spirit of the Enlightenment and his promotion of secularism and philosophical materialism. It was, however, the giant figure of Blessed Pius IX, known popularly as Pio Nono, who would stamp the papal seal of authority on the century. Although Pius IX was a firm tradition-oriented Catholic, he was not an enemy of technology. Shortly after his election in 1846, he set up a commission to introduce railways into the papal states, and he installed gas street lighting in Rome. The enemy was not technological progress, but the progressive determinism of Enlightenment philosophy and its political manifestation in the form of secularist revolution. In 1848, this philosophy led to revolutions across the length of Europe. In France, the restored monarchy was once again overthrown and replaced with a new secularist and anti-Catholic republic. A secularist republic was also established in Rome, forcing the Pope to flee the city. He responded with characteristic resolve by excommunicating all the participants in the short-lived republic. For all his resolve in the war on secularism, Pius IX was resolute above all in his practice of the faith. A saintly man, he was so poor at the time of his election that he had to borrow the money to get him to the conclave which elected him. Following his election, he was hands-on in his pastoral ministry to the people of Rome, visiting hospitals and schools, confirming children, and distributing communion in obscure churches and chapels. The effect of his papacy can be seen in a deepening and renewal of the spiritual life of the Church. He encouraged frequent reception of the sacraments and devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus and to the Blessed Virgin. In his encyclical Ubi Primum, he emphasized Mary's role in salvation, and in 1854 he promulgated the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, informing with papal authority the age-old Catholic belief that the Mother of God was conceived without the stain of original sin. Pius IX's promulgation of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception was confirmed miraculously by heaven itself in 1858 with several apparitions of the Blessed Virgin to a 14-year-old peasant girl, Bernadette Soubirous. At one of these apparitions, the Virgin told St. Bernadette, "I am the Immaculate Conception." So much could and should be said about these miraculous apparitions and the numerous miracles of healing that followed afterwards. The very fact that Our Lady should choose to reveal herself in this way to a virgin of about the age that she was herself when she conceived the Son of God is testament to the poetic symmetry of this revelation of God's love for fallen humanity. The fact that the place chosen for such an apparition was fallen France is itself symbolically charged. The mother of the church appears miraculously to the oldest and most rebellious of the church's daughters. Like her son, she comes not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. This aspect of the apparitions was emphasized by Ronald Knox. Quote, "It was during the sixth apparition that Our Lady said suddenly, 'Pray for sinners.' When Our Lady stood at the grotto, the first command she gave was not 'heal the sick,' was not 'convert the unbeliever.' Her command was 'pray for sinners.' Man's sin, that is our real malady. Man's impenitence, that is the crying problem." End quote. Such was the good news of the church's resurrection and Our Lady's revelation of herself that the many great saints of the century are reduced to being a mere postscript or even footnote. Here is a litany of some of the most noteworthy in vaguely chronological order. Elizabeth Ann Seton, Peter Chanel, Jean-Marie Vianney, John Neumann, Anthony Marie Claret, John Bosco, John Henry Newman, Thérèse of Lisieux, and last but not least, the Korean, Chinese, Ugandan, and Vietnamese martyrs. We will conclude with Ronald Knox, once again waxing lyrical, this time on the saints in general and St. Thérèse of Lisieux in particular. Quote, "The saints are our Lord's crown, and in that crown, one particular jewel catches the light now and again, so as to shine out more than ever. All the saints have possessed the virtue of simplicity, but it was not till God saw fit to give us a really glaring example of saintly simplicity in St. Teresa that the church really noticed what a wonderful thing it is." So that's the section on the good in the chapter on the 19th century. Now we will turn to the bad. The 19th century could be seen as the age in which the worst sort of nationalism emerged as an even worse sort of imperialism. It might be said in this context that there are two types of nationalism. There is the healthy nationalism of small nations that seeks independence from the imperial designs of larger neighbours. And there is the unhealthy nationalism of large nations that exerts imperial power over smaller neighbours. The century began with two large and imperial nations at loggerheads. Napoleon would rise from being the ruler of France to becoming a self-styled emperor of all he surveyed, expanding his dominions through military conquest. His main rival was the emergent imperial power of Britain, which in 1801 annexed Ireland in an act of union. The new British flag, the Union flag, or more popularly the Union Jack, consisted of the juxtaposed crosses of St. George, St. Andrew, and St. Patrick, signifying the union of England, Scotland, and Ireland, through the coming together symbolically of those nations' patron saints. Under this flag, the British would conquer large parts of the world. By the century's end, almost a quarter of the world's population and almost a quarter of the world's land area would be part of the British Empire. It was, therefore, through the monstrous politics of scale that imperialism would replace nationalism as the defining element of global politics. In fact, the embryonic beginnings of the globalism we see today. In the United States, the North and South went to war over the issues of slavery and states' rights. The South, unable to unshackle itself from the abomination of slavery, was defeated by the industrial North, which then imposed a strong central government on the states of the Union, empowering a federal government which has inexorably centralized power to a degree that has rendered the individual states relatively powerless. Whereas Britannia ruled the waves, facilitating the expansion of its global empire, Germany sought to rule the landmass of Europe through the flexing of its political muscle. In 1866, Prussia defeated Austria, and then, in 1870, it defeated France in the Franco-Prussian War. In the following year, to rub salt into the wounds of the defeated French, Wilhelm I of Prussia chose to have himself crowned Emperor of the German Empire in Paris. The new German Empire would be no friend of the Church. Under the leadership of the ruthless Otto von Bismarck, the first Chancellor of the Empire, war was declared on the Catholic population of the new unified Germany. Between 1871 and 1875, Bismarck abolished the Church's control of its own schools, imposing state education, and expelled the Jesuits and other religious orders from Germany. The state took over Catholic seminaries and claimed the right to appoint the clergy. Those Catholics who defied the government were severely punished. As a little aside here, one of my favourite poems, and I think one of the best poems ever written, is a poem called The Wreck of the Deutschland by Giovanni Hopkins, a Jesuit convert to the faith who I might mention later. I might not, can't remember. but that poem is basically about shipwreck off the coast of England and about five Franciscan sisters who basically served, one in particular, a giantess over 6 foot tall, who serves a St. John the Baptist figure in the midst of the shipwreck, calling those about to die, possibly to repentance. It's made the newspapers and inspired Hopkins' poem. Those five Franciscan sisters were being expelled from Prussia under the Fulk Laws and were on their way to the United States to found a Franciscan house in the Midwest somewhere, I think Missouri. But all five of them perished in that shipwreck. But the poem, if you haven't read it, is absolutely worth your reading. The Catholic resistance was truly admirable. Still speaking about Prussia here. Hundreds of priests were imprisoned, as were the archbishops of Poznan and Cologne and the bishop of Treves. Treves. T-R-E-V-E-S.
Treves.
Okay. I mean, if you're all confused, what chance do I have? I'm only English.
Treves.
Thank you very much. This war on the Church became known as the Kulturkampf, the culture struggle, or in modern parlance, the culture wars. In spite of Bismarck's determined efforts to crush the Church, the people rallied in defense of their religion. The Catholic Center Party was gaining ground in the elections, and there was a proliferation of pro-Catholic newspapers and journals. Eventually, after 7 years of relentless persecution and equally relentless and resilient resistance, Bismarck admitted defeat. Unable to crush the Church, he sought reconciliation. The anti-Catholic laws were repealed, and the Church once again began building its schools, colleges, hospitals, universities, and all the multifarious social organizations which re-established and fortified the role of the faith in the very fabric of German society. In 1870, even as Prussia was invading France, Italian unification was achieved by the conquering of the Papal States and the invasion of papal-controlled Rome. Pius IX, as fearless and indomitable as ever, refused to abandon the Eternal City, even though he was now deprived of any temporal political power. As the prisoner of the Vatican, as he became known, Pius IX gained both respect and sympathy from around the world, increasing his spiritual power, even as his temporal power had been lost. The same was true of the loss of the Papal States, which was seen at the time as a disaster. The liberation of the popes from the burden of being secular rulers enabled them to focus on their spiritual missions to the world at large. Following France's defeat in the Franco-Prussian War, the government of the Third Republic mimicked the policies of its Prussian enemy by initiating a new anti-Catholic pogrom, which was itself a Quarterkampf, as draconian as Bismarck's. Convents and monasteries were closed, resulting in more than 100,000 monks and nuns being made homeless. And no religious congregation could exist without gaining explicit approval from the government. The last 20 years of the 19th century were marked by a manic scramble by the major European powers to claim as much of the defenceless continent of Africa as their military and economic resources could deliver. In 1881, Tunisia became a French protectorate, and Egypt became part of the British Empire a year later. At the Berlin Conference, held in 1884 and 1885, the European nations decided to carve up the African continent peacefully, ostensibly with the laudable goal of stamping out slavery. In practice, however, it was all about grabbing power in an increasingly competitive global economy. France, Britain, Spain, Germany, Italy, Portugal, and Belgium all claimed their piece of the cake. France ended up with most of the northern part of the continent, with Britain claiming the lion's share of the rest. By 1900, 30% of the African population had been annexed to the British Empire. In addition, Britain now ruled the Indian subcontinent, enabling Queen Victoria to claim the title of the Empress of India. In terms of secular politics, the 19th century could be seen as an age of revolutions and an age of imperialism. The revolutions had sought to destroy the city of God in the name of the city of man, whereas the emerging imperial powers had sought to turn the city of man into the empire of man. Napoleon had claimed the imperial crown in 1804, Wilhelm I in 1871, and Queen Victoria 5 years later. In each case, the omnipotent empire would prove short-lived. In Napoleon's case, the empire would die before he did. As for the German and British empires, they would both begin to crumble in the trenches of World War I, less than two decades after the demise of the century which had given them birth. Sic transit gloria mundi. So much for the bad. We always like to end on a happy note, don't we? The beautiful. It is no surprise and no coincidence that the resurrection of the good in the 19th century should be accompanied by the revival of the beautiful. Ever the two go hand in hand. The revival of beauty was connected to the rise of Romanticism, which was itself a healthy reactionary response to the cold-hearted empiricism and scientism of the Enlightenment of the previous century. In addition, it was also, at least in England, the Romanticism in Germany and Spain and other countries is somewhat different. In addition, it was also, at least in England, a healthy reactionary response to the wickedness of the French Revolution. English Romanticism can be said to have been born with the publication in 1798 of Lyrical Ballads, a volume of poetry co-authored by William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge. So one thing, by the way, it's difficult for us to understand in the 21st century that a book of poetry could actually have such a revolutionary impact. But seriously, this one volume co-authored by those two poets impacted the whole culture of the 20th century. I shall talk about that now. These two poets had been initially disillusioned with Christianity, one more than the other, and admirers of the revolution in France. In the event, the grim reality of the Reign of Terror, which followed the revolution, led both poets to become disillusioned with the revolution and admirers of, and then believers in, Christianity. Their path would be followed by many others. The Romantic movement in England giving birth to various forms of neo-medievalism, especially the Gothic revival, the Pre-Raphaelites, and the Oxford movement. I'm going to paraphrase this section of the chapter, just might speed things up a bit. So basically, you know, throughout history, intellectual history, because we can't create anything ex nihilo, we play leapfrog, right? So the reaction against the empiricism of the Enlightenment was to try to seek something that was purer than that, and you leapfrogged over the whole period of the Enlightenment, and you rediscover the Middle Ages. So one consequence of the Romantic movement in 19th century, especially in England, was the various forms of neo-medievalism, a rediscovery of the Middle Ages. And this took three specific forms. The Gothic Revival, principally in architecture. So the best example of that, that we'll all know, is the House of Parliament in London, Big Ben and the rest of it. That was designed by Augustus Pugin, who was at the forefront of the Gothic Revival in architecture. He would become a Catholic, take his Gothic principles to their logical conclusion. If you're going to go back to the Middle Ages, go back to the religion of the Middle Ages as well. That was his rationale. And he becomes the first of a trickle of what would become a flood of converts throughout the 19th century in England. But also around this time, following Catholic emancipation in 1829, it became legal for the first time in 300 years, yes, to build Catholic churches in England. Most of those Catholic churches that were built in that time throughout England were built according to the Neo-Gothic, many of them by Augustus Pugin directly. So the Gothic Revival in architecture being the first manifestation of neo-medievalism. Then you had the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood in art. And as its name would suggest, the Pre-Raphaelites were seeking a purer vision of art that was pre-Raphael. So the idea that the Renaissance becomes humanistic, in other words, being anthropocentric and not theocentric, at around the time of Raphael. I think it was John Ruskin, the neo-Gothic art historian of the 19th century, that said Venice was transformed from being a medieval virgin to being a Renaissance Venus. So this what you might call erotic fall. So the Pre-Raphaelites sought a purer vision of art that went back to the medieval and the early Renaissance. And they chose, perhaps appropriately for their subjects, Arthurian, some knights in shining armor, the King Arthur legends, Dante's Divine Comedy, and although it's not going back quite as far, they also love depicting scenes from Shakespeare. And then the third, and perhaps from the perspective of the Catholic Revival, at least in the English-speaking world, was the Oxford Movement. And the Oxford Movement was a movement within the Church of England that also sought to leapfrog over the whole of the Enlightenment period, but also further over the whole of the Reformation, and seek to graft the modern English Anglican Church onto its medieval ancestor, the Catholic Church of the pre-Reformation. So the Oxford Movement sort of said that the Anglican Church is like the Orthodox Church and the Roman Church, they're all different branches of the true Catholic Church, right? So if you like, Athens, Rome, and Canterbury. And one of the leaders of the Oxford Movement was someone named John Henry Newman, and through his study of history, basically through his study of history and theology, came to the conclusion that the Anglican Church was not actually part of that authentic Catholic Church at all, but was a real breach from that, and that the Anglican Church was not part of the Catholic Church, but was part of the Protestant Reformation. And following his principles, he became a Catholic. And his conversion in 1845 was the definitive birth of the Catholic revival. So these are all things happening in England at that time. I should say something that Newman was received in the church in 1845. In 1866, he received a young man in the church by the name of Jeremiah Manley Hopkins, who I've mentioned already, as with respect to the wreck of the Deutschland. And Hopkins would go on to become a Jesuit priest and certainly one of the greatest poets in the English language ever. The 19th century, taking up the text again, the 19th century was also the golden age of the novel. Time precludes any discussion of the great novelists who graced this greatest of literary centuries, but we must at least list the illustrissimi: Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, Alessandro Manzoni, Victor Hugo, Leo Tolstoy, and Fyodor Dostoevsky, and I'm sure you all have sins of omission, you could scream at me from that. Each of these giants of literature represented aspects of the widespread Christian revival that characterized cultural renewal throughout the century, each in their own individual and sometimes idiosyncratic way. In France, François-René de Chateaubriand was a literary giant who defended the church with great lucidity and literary eloquence in the first half of the century. Take, for instance, the epigrammatic brilliance of his defense of the church as a divine institution. Quote, Christianity is perfect. Men are imperfect. Christianity, therefore, is not the work of men. In Germany, there was a Catholic revival in the early decades of the century, which was led by accomplished writers and scholars, many of whom were converts to the faith. Leaders of this revival included Friedrich Leopold Stolberg, Friedrich Schlegel, Joseph Gores, and Johann Adam Möller. Accompanying this intellectual aspect of the Catholic revival in Germany was the influence of German Romanticism, which, like its contemporary counterpart in England, spawned various manifestations of neo-medievalism. Whereas neo-medievalism in England had expressed itself primarily in the poetry and prose of the Romantics and in neo-Gothic architecture and pre-Raphaelite painting, it found expression most potently in German culture in the form of music. The music historian Susan Tracy evokes the excitement generated by the brilliance of Beethoven in the early 19th century. Quote, try to imagine yourself in Vienna at a marathon concert that included the world premieres of Beethoven's 5th and 6th symphonies, his 4th piano concerto, opus 58 G major, and his Fantasia in C minor, opus 80, popularly known as the Choral Fantasy. These four works truly were premiered at the same concert on December the 22nd, 1808. Apart from these completely new works, which were being performed for the very first time, the concert program that evening also included the Gloria and Sanctus from Beethoven's Mass in C major. 5 years later, E.T.A. Hoffmann would write in his essay, Beethoven's Instrumental Music, that instrumental music, it, quote, is the most romantic of all arts. One might almost say the only genuinely romantic one, for its sole subject is the infinite. Hoffmann continued that Beethoven's music in particular, quote, wakens that infinite longing which is the essence of romanticism. Such longing is what C.S. Lewis called joy, an essential characteristic of man's longing for God. Another great composer of the time was Franz Schubert, whose Ave Maria has remained enduringly popular. It was originally composed as a German translation of a song from Sir Walter Scott's narrative poem, The Lady of the Lake, illustrating the influence of English, and in this case Scottish, romantic literature and neo-medieval Arthurian themes on German romantic music. In Scott's poem, the protagonist is singing to the Blessed Virgin, including the refrain, Ave Maria, but the words are not those of the Hail Mary prayer. Perhaps the most controversial figure in 19th century German music is Richard Wagner, who put his incomparable musical gifts at the service of a quasi or pseudo-pagan devotion to the ancient Norse gods. This apparently anti-Christian stance earned him the admiration of Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher of superbia par excellence. Such admiration was terminated unceremoniously when Wagner's final music drama, Parsifal, was perceived by Nietzsche as a surrender to Christianity. Although the work is somewhat idiosyncratic theologically, Wagner also seemed to believe that it represented his reconciliation with Christianity, writing to his patron, King Ludwig II of Bavaria, that, quote, it seems to me as if the making of this work has been entrusted to me in order to uphold to the world its own most profound mystery, the truth of the Christian faith, indeed, even to rekindle this faith, end quote. Another musical giant of this period is Anton Bruckner, who might be considered the Catholic Wagner. Greatly influenced by Wagner, Bruckner's Mass in D minor puts Wagnerian musical innovation at the service of God. The importance and centrality of Bruckner's Catholic faith was emphasized by Susan Tracy. Quote, though Bruckner is known primarily as a symphonic composer, his sacred music deserves to be better known. Bruckner's Catholic faith shines forth in his liturgical music, from the sublime motets, Ave Maria and Os Justi, to his larger sacred choral works. Bruckner's masses and his Te Deum are like vocal symphonies, or, as some have commented, his symphonies are rather like masses without words. It would be remiss to omit reference to Italian opera in a survey of all that's beautiful in the 19th century. The operas of the earlier part of the century by Rossini and Bellini appear to be preoccupied, if not obsessed, with the tragedy of English history during the reign of the Tudors and Stuarts. Another influence was the Scottish romantic author Sir Walter Scott. Rossini wrote an operatic adaptation of Scott's The Lady of the Lake, which, as we have seen, had also inspired Schubert, whereas Donizetti adapted Scott's The Bride of Lammas Moor. As with Wagner, the greatest of the 19th century Italian composers, Giuseppe Verdi, ended his life with at least a partial rejection of his earlier revolutionary views. After the success of Aida in 1871, he retired from composing opera to compose his famous Requiem. This would have been his final word as a composer, and perhaps his artistic last will and testament, if he hadn't been persuaded to come out of retirement to compose an adaptation of Shakespeare's Othello, which includes the beautiful Ave Maria, sung by the doomed Desdemona, and his final work, Falstaff, a comedy inspired by the feckless buffoon who disgraces several of Shakespeare's plays. We will conclude our brief survey of the beautiful music of the 19th century in France, which also experienced a Catholic revival in the latter half of the century to complement the early revival set in motion by Chateaubriand. This period, sometimes referred to as the Belle Époque, includes the restoration of Gregorian chant, begun in the 1850s at the Benedictine Abbey of St. Peter of Solesmes, which continues to enrich the church liturgically to this day. Perhaps the greatest French composer of this period is Gabriel Fauré, who is best known, and justly, for his wonderful Requiem. Finally, to close our sketch of the 19th century, we'll offer a panoramic overview of the great paintings which graced this period of Catholic revival. The first great painter of the century was Francisco de Goya, whose most celebrated paintings illustrate the sheer brutality of the city of man. His Colossus shows a chaotic and possibly demonic presence which darkens the cosmos. Michael Levy conjectures that it may symbolize, quote, the collapse of rationality, perhaps, and the birth of monsters, or possibly a feeling of despair as the modern world comes painfully into existence, end quote. That's the view of an atheist. I'm not going to argue with him, though. It was painted at around the same time as Mary Shelley was writing Frankenstein, which could suggest a sense of angst in the presence of the monsters of scientific modernity. It is more likely, however, it is simply a representation of the wickedness of the times in which it was painted. The latter is suggested by the subject of arguably his most famous painting, the 3rd of May, 1808, which shows French soldiers killing defenceless hostages in cold blood. In England, William Blake's eccentric genius enabled him to write some of the finest poetry of the time and also inspired him to execute some of the finest art. His poetry, ranging from theologically mystic musings on the symbolism of God's creation of the lamb and the tiger, to an Arthurian call to arms in his timeless anthem, Jerusalem. It also inspired him to take up the brush to bring to life, in his own mind's eye, the mystical vision of Dante or Milton. Other great English art of the century, apart from the aforementioned and very important Pre-Raphaelites, was the proto-impressionism of Turner and Constable, which prefigures and prophesies the French Impressionist movement of several decades later. From a Catholic perspective, the most pertinent of the French Impressionist paintings are Monet's representations of the facade of Rouen Cathedral, illumined by various hues of sunlight, of which the resplendent magnificence of the cathedral in full sunlight is the most striking, suggestive of the sun's placing of a halo on the hallowed edifice. We will end, however, with Millet's quintessentially timeless masterpiece, The Angelus, which shows two peasants, a husband and wife, pausing from the day's labours at the prompting of the church bells to pray the Angelus. The painting is not an icon, but is beyond iconic in its evocation of the perennial power of prayer. The two peasants are apparently powerless in the presence of worldly wickedness, and yet they have the hidden and silent power of the peasants of the Vendée, who rose up in defiance of the colossus of the French Revolution. Even more important, they have the hidden and silent power of the poor peasant girl who knelt in awe of the presence of the apparition of the Blessed Virgin at Lourdes. Most important of all, they have the power of the poor peasant girl who knelt in the presence of an angel in a small town called Nazareth. It was this presence which had overcome the imperial power of the city of man, and by the grace of God and the miraculous apparition of the mother of his mother at Lourdes, had been born anew. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this podcast. This is Phil Lawler speaking for the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at Thomas More College. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation, and I hope you'll register on our website to receive information about future events hosted by the Center. If you find these recordings helpful, please help us to continue our work by making a tax-deductible contribution. We cannot continue to provide fine programming without the support of people like you, and we're grateful for your help. To receive updates on our activities or to make a contribution to our work, see our webpage at restorationchristianculture.org. That's all lowercase with no spaces or punctuation, restorationchristianculture.org. Thank you again.